Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The metal workers' strike in South Africa brings worries about the effect on the nation's economy. Nigerian villagers ask for help from the United Nations. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Reuters news agency reports worries are mounting in South Africa that the strike by 200,000 engineering and metal workers could destabilize the economy. The strike by the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, or NUMSA, is in its fourth day. The union is seeking wage hikes of 12% to 15%. There was some violence reported on picket lines on Thursday. The strike is the latest in a series of labor actions that have hit South Africa. As the result of the strike, General Motors says it has suspended production at its main plant in South Africa. The AFP News Service says authorities have fired 8 South African policemen because of the mistreatment and death of a Mozambican immigrant. The immigrant was seen on an online video being dragged behind a police vehicle. The man, 27-year-old taxi driver Mido Masia, died in police custody last February after being arrested for parking his taxi on the wrong side of the road. The 8 former officers are due to stand trial on murder charges next year. The AFP News Service is reporting that that a group of villagers in northeast Nigeria are asking for United Nations help to ward off violence in the region. The villagers are from a town in the Chibok district where Boko Haram Islamic extremists kidnapped 200 schoolgirls. A local elder told a news conference in Abuja that the group has killed more than 200 people in 15 attacks on 19 villages in his region since the April 14th abduction of the girls. Reuters reports that Nigerian soldiers fired into the air and burned buses after one of their colleagues was killed in a bus accident on the Lagos mainland. An official says there were no deaths or injuries in the rampage. The AFP News agency reports that the UN Refugee Agency is charging that Sudan has forcibly repatriated European refugees. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says the lives and liberty of the refugees is at risk. The UN says about 4,000 refugees flee repression in Sudan each month. The AFP is reporting that Burundian human rights activist Pierre Claver Mbonimpa has gone on trial on charges of endangering national security. Singing supporters gathered as Mbonimpa was brought into the court under heavy security. He is charged with publicly criticizing what he said was military training being given to young members of the ruling party of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He is said to have leaked a UN report making the charge, which the government denies. Israeli police fought with Palestinian protesters in East Jerusalem today as thousands of people gathered to mourn the Palestinian teenager killed in a suspected revenge attack. Israeli police had increased security in anticipation of demonstrations following the funeral of Mohammed Abu Qudair. Authorities said they are investigating whether the killing was in response to an earlier kidnapping and murder of 3 Israeli teens. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says Ukraine is ready to hold a new round of talks with pro-Russian separatist leaders and Russian officials on Saturday. His office said today that he told European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton in a telephone call that he is suggesting a time and place for the talks and is waiting for confirmation from the other party. Chinese President Xi Jinping has denounced what he called Japan's barbaric colonial aggression against China and Korea. During a speech today at Seoul National University, Mr. Xi said Chinese and South Koreans experienced enormous suffering as a result of Japan's aggression in the first half of the 20th century. The comments come a day after Mr. Xi offered to hold joint memorial activities with South Korea to mark next year's 70th anniversary of Japan's defeat in World War II. Many observers see Mr. Xi's trip to South Korea as part of an attempt by the Chinese government to bring South Korea closer into its sphere of influence and thereby alienate Japan. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
City Police Commissioner Nelson Marwa says they will seriously deal with those who want to start chaos.
That's Mombasa City Police Commissioner Nelson Marwa. Details coming up. Also in the news, a strike by 220,000 engineers and metal workers has dealt another blow to South Africa's economy. And as Malawi celebrates 50 years of independence July 6th, Malawians still live below the poverty level. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Sudan is preparing to mark 3 years of independence, but an ongoing conflict and faltering peace process have prompted some serious soul-searching about the country's political future. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports on efforts to push a political reset in the form of a transitional government.
While it should be a time of celebration, South Sudan is limping towards its third anniversary, July 9th. The country continues to be torn apart by a power dispute between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar that turned violent late last year. Inter-ethnic fighting between forces loyal to President Kiir and rebels aligned with Machar has left thousands dead and more than 1 million displaced. In an effort to lift the country out of its downward spiral, the two leaders agreed in May to establish a transitional government of national unity. A month later, on June 10th, they set a 60-day deadline to form the interim government. But talks between the two sides have once again broken down due to opposition complaints about the exclusion of displaced people and groups in exile from the talks. South Sudanese Information Minister Michael Makwe-Lueth told VOA the government is still waiting for instructions from the East African Bloc of States, IGAD, which has been mediating talks.
If we are called, we are optimistic that we will reach peace and agree within the 60 days as was scheduled.
As reconciliation efforts continue to falter, citizens are becoming impatient with the country's leadership. A senior U.S. State Department official, David Feldstein, traveled to South Sudan this week on a mission to speak to civil society groups and organizations to hear their thoughts on the way forward. He told VOA, people are growing tired of both President Kiir and opposition leader Machar.
The biggest frustration is the fact that I think a lot of people feel that the future, their own futures have been hijacked by two people who don't necessarily have the country's best interest in mind, but are certainly concerned about their own self-interest.
Some observers have suggested that both President Kiir and Machar should be excluded from a transitional government, but both sides have ruled out that possibility. Information Minister Lueth said the president has to stay on to implement peace agreements.
But there isn't quite the space yet, and there isn't quite a natural turn to when it comes to moving this process beyond sort of the two people who are currently engaged in on-again, off-again and peace talks. So I think that's a challenge.
Meanwhile, the country's humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate. A group of British aid agencies warned this week that conflict, displacement and a lack of donor funds could push some populations into famine in the coming weeks. Gabe Jaslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenyan security officials in the coastal city of Mombasa say they have beefed up security in areas prone to violence as political and tribal tensions grow in the country. The political opposition is expected to hold a major rally in the capital, Nairobi, next week to press the government to convene a national forum to discuss the country's worsening security, economic and political situation. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Mombasa.
There has been tangible tension in the air in recent weeks as the opposition led by former Prime Minister Raila Odinga crisscrossed the country holding public rallies, demanding the government to convene a national forum. As a political showdown looms at a Nairobi rally on Monday over how the country should be managed, the impact is being felt far away from the capital. Kenya media reports some communities are leaving the conflict-prone Rift Valley for fears of attacks. The region was the center of most of the political violence and intercommunal fighting that erupted around elections 7 years ago. That violence left more than 1,100 people dead and displaced hundreds of thousands of Kenyans. Hundreds of kilometers away in the country's second largest city, Mombasa, security officers are on high alert for a variety of types of violence. City Police Commissioner Nelson Marwa says they will seriously deal with those who want to start chaos.
You cannot just sit back and watch criminals take over a system. You have to act back. And how, even if it is developed countries, do you just sit and watch criminals kill innocent citizens? You act. So we are not ready to just to sit back as a country.
In 2008, post-election violence, police were accused of not doing enough to protect civilians and stop the violence. Now, Marwa says they are providing more security to some areas in the city they feel are vulnerable.
We feel certain areas in the county are already being given special emphasis. Just like you go in other countries. Some of them are slum areas, and you know, slum areas have specific characteristics. Poor people live in slum areas, and unemployed youth live in slum areas. It is easy to manipulate a poor person. It is easy to manipulate an unemployed person. You give him some small money, he takes it into the streets. Right. That's why we are saying these are specific areas we should safeguard, ensure that there is tight security there.
Mombasa has been plagued by a more recent spate of violence, with a wave of attacks linked to Islamist militants, sectarian backlashes and crackdown on secessionists. Just last month, a group of gunmen stormed the coastal town of Pekotoni, killing more than 60 people and torching properties worth millions. In his address to the nation after that attack, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that violence was ethnically motivated, despite a claim by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab that it carried out the attack. Lamu Governor Isa Timami was arrested in connection with the Mpeketoni incident. Timami was charged with murder, forceful eviction of population and terrorism. The governor was released on June 30th on a $57,000 cash bail by a high court in Mombasa. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Mombasa.
A strike by 220,000 engineers and metal workers has dealt another blow to South Africa's economy just a week after settlement of the most damaging previous work stoppage in the country's history. As Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg, the new labor dispute has been marked by violent clashes between police and striking workers and reports of looting and intimidation by union members.
The industrial action was called by the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, or NUMSA, the country's largest union. NUMSA is demanding a 12% pay raise and better housing allowances for workers. This latest strike affects around 10,500 companies, including steel producers, foundries, construction companies and automotive suppliers. General Motors South Africa suspended vehicle assembly in Port Elizabeth on Thursday, saying that the strike left no other option. The company builds around 50,000 vehicles a year. Gishma Johnson is the communications manager for General Motors SA.
The ongoing labour disruptions are harming the South African economy and are affecting the country's image around the globe. We therefore recommend that government, business and labour need to work together in a constructive manner to implement solutions which are in the best interest of the country as a whole.
A protracted strike could also exacerbate construction delays at two badly needed power stations being built by Eskom, the state utility. Police fired rubber bullets Thursday at workers who were blocking an entrance to the Eskom Madubi power station construction site. There were local radio reports of striking workers assaulting people and looting offices in Johannesburg. NUMSA has denied the allegations. Ratings agency Moody's has warned that this strike, combined with a weak investment climate, could lead to another credit downgrade. That would increase loan costs for borrowers and likely damage investor confidence, which has already been bashed by the country's lingering strike season. South Africa is still reeling from a five-month-long strike by platinum workers. The walkout cost three main platinum mining firms $2.25 billion in lost revenue. Negotiations in the metal workers' strike have been unsuccessful so far, but discussions are expected to continue through the weekend. For businesses in South Africa, a settlement cannot come soon enough. The latest stoppage is estimated to be costing around $28 million a day. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In South Sudan, another former senior member of the country's ruling party, SPLM, has joined rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. Peter Adwok Niaba says he joined the SPLM in opposition to fight for change. Niaba says he escaped from Juba last week and is now in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Niaba was the Minister of Education before President Salva Kiir sacked his entire cabinet a year ago this month. Niaba was also arrested along with his 11 colleagues for allegedly attempting to overthrow President Kiir. Niaba resigned from the ruling party last month, citing poor leadership in the SPLM. In a conversation with reporter John Tanza, he accuses the Kiir administration of putting him under house arrest for over 6 months without any charges.
So I've been under house arrest since December 31st, when they took me off the plane bound for Dubai and they impounded my passport. So since then I've been under some kind of house arrest. An opportunity presented itself to go to Rumbek to accompany the body of one of my colleagues who passed away in the United States, Professor Bolkolok. And I've got that as an opportunity to get out of South Sudan.
From Rumbek, where did you go? From Rumbek?
Yeah, chartered a flight from Rumbek straight to Nairobi. And from Nairobi, I came to Addis.
What are you doing in Addis?
Yes. Well, in Addis, I've decided to join with the opposition in order to work for peace and getting our country out of this situation it is in.
When you say you have joined the opposition, which opposition group have you joined?
Well, there's only one opposition now. That is the SPLM in opposition.
Your other colleagues who were detained with you in December, when they were released, they say they will work for peace and they opted not to join the government or the opposition. Why did you join the SPLM in opposition?
No, but they are different from me. I mean, this is their own choice. I don't know how they are working for peace in the way things are. I'm working for peace in the context of the struggle against Salva Kiir's dictatorship because there's unleashed war on our people. We are now in a civil war. And the only way to really to defeat it is to join those also who carry arms and face it.
You were there in Juba until last week. You told me that you were in a house arrest. How is the situation in Juba? We hear so many conflicting reports. How is the situation in Juba?
Things are getting worse and worse. As a result of the war, the lives of people is deteriorating. People's rights and human rights are being abused daily. I mean, you hear of people being killed, not only being killed, but also beheaded, you know, saying that they cannot be identified.
How would you describe the situation that you went through since December until you escaped from South Sudan?
Well, it was horrible, to say the least, because to be confined and one's rights, which are enshrined in the constitution, are violated. I think it's a very horrible situation.
A lot of South Sudanese that I've spoken to are saying they don't want any fighting. They are tired of fighting. Is there a way that this problem will be solved on the battlefields?
But how can you avoid fighting if the incumbent is even preventing people? Look at how he is threatening anybody who is talking about federation in South Sudan. Because the system that has been instituted since 2005 has not really met the aspirations of our people. Now people are asking for federation, saying that really this concentration of power, this which in the hands of a few cliques who are losing the resources of the country and who are oppressing the people, taking their land, is stopped.
That's former senior SPLM member Peter Adiok Niabi. He was speaking to reporter John Tanza from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Twenty past the hour. You were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Malawi celebrates 50 years of independence July 6th, but many say there is little to celebrate when statistics show that many Malawians still live below the poverty level. A half a century on, Malawi continues begging for contributions. 40% of its national budget comes from international donors. Lamek Masina has the story from Blantyre.
To celebrate its golden jubilee, the Malawi government is spending about 370,000 United States dollars for national celebrations at Sivo Stadium in the capital, Lilongwe, to include an international friendly football match between Malawi and Mozambique and live music performances by local artists. Despite the pomp and euphoria, some people say they are in no mood to celebrate. Stella Mwambakulu is a resident of Jinsapo Township, a densely populated area in Lilongwe. The widowed mother of three children, she told VOA that although the national celebrations will be held a walkable distance from her residence, she sees no reason to attend.
I can't go there as an individual to my family, to my village. It doesn't mean anything. Why should we celebrate when women are still dying in the hospital? Because they can't access medicines in the hospital. Women are still walking long distances to access potable water. Why should we celebrate when ordinary Malawians still survive on less than a dollar a day?
She suggests the government should have used the money budgeted for the celebrations on initiatives that will help uplift the lives of ordinary Malawians. Joseph Coopins, the executive director for the Center for Social Concern. His organization issues monthly reviews of the cost of living of Malawians through the Basic Needs Basket Survey. He says his statistics show more than 65% of Malawians still live below the poverty level, which is less than $2 per day. Coopins say population growth from 4 million people in 1964 to the current 15 million is one of the reasons for such high poverty levels, but there is another big factor.
Whatever the country is trying to do in order to alleviate or eradicate poverty will be problematic because of the increase in population. The second thing is that resources that are supposed to go to the people are actually being used but by a select few. That is very evident in the whole Cashgate saga.
The corruption scandal known as Cashgate erupted in 2013 when it was discovered that 30 million United States dollars in government funds was siphoned off by civil servants, business people, and government officials. International donors suspended critical funds in response, citing the need for accountability. There were arrests, promises of tackling corruption, and a new election and the government installed. But the former director of public prosecution, Fahad Asani, says corruption is endemic in Malawi, estimating that 30% of the government budget is lost through fraud and corruption annually. While corruption is cited as a major obstacle to tackling poverty, there are other structural issues also at play. Professor of Economics at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi, Benny Kalua, says Malawi has for the past 5 decades been experiencing economic challenges because of lack of well-thought-out policies on agriculture, the country's major source of income. Agriculture accounts for 37% of Malawi's GDP, 85% of its export revenue, and employs 80% of the labor force.
We are still stuck in smallholder agriculture. You find that smallholder agriculture takes quite a big chunk of our budget. And then that is linked us into this poverty situation, which is still quite prevalent in Malawi.
He says the small farmer economy keeps the tax base small and the government unable to raise needed funds to improve the infrastructure and grow the economy. Malawi's newly elected president, Peter Mutharika, promised in his State of the Nation address that it is time to change Malawi's status as one of the least developed countries. He is pledging to curb corruption, reform agriculture with a special emphasis on irrigation farming and infrastructure development, and to grow the economy by 7% in the next 5 years. After 50 years of independence, 20 years of multi-party democracy, many Malawians say if the president can achieve what he promises, there will be a reason to celebrate when Malawi turns 55 years old. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
In Egypt, Security officials say a bomb accidentally exploded at a house south of Cairo, killing three suspected militants. The blast took place in a building in the town of Abu Qasa in Fayoum province. Reuters news agency says experts were defusing more than 20 other explosives at the site. And yesterday, on the anniversary of the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, five people died in a bomb blast and in clashes between security forces and protesters. It's been almost 3 months since more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. The kidnapping made headlines worldwide and several countries, including the United States, promised to help bring the girls back to their families. But as Mariama Diallo reports, the girls are still missing and advocates for their return are growing frustrated.
3 weeks after the girls were kidnapped by Boko Haram, demonstrations demanding action took place in many cities, including Washington.
Girls are not for sale.
The hashtag Bring Back Our Girls trended on social media, along with a photo of the U.S. First Lady holding up a sign to show her support. But nearly 90 days after the abduction, there are those who feel the drive and the passion to find the girls seems to have diminished. Omolola Adeleosho was the lead organizer of a rally in front of the Nigerian embassy in Washington. She spoke to us via Skype.
The unfortunate part is that, you know, we are now in a world of, you know, life cycle news where everything is, you know, 2 days and it's out of everybody's memory. Right after the rally, then, you know, the issues of Iraq, the rescued soldier from Afghanistan, you know, all these things have been happening, especially in American news.
Some say because of the new demands in Iraq, the U.S. has scaled back its intelligence and surveillance mission in Nigeria. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby refutes that presumption and says that since the original surge of efforts, the U.S. has been joined by more coalition partners.
Are we flying exactly as many flights as we were at the outset? No. But the same level of effort is being sustained now internationally by everybody.
Mary Harf, the State Department spokesperson, says the U.S. still maintains a significant level of cooperation.
Obviously, the kidnapping, other attacks that have happened since then have prompted us to increase our assistance, to do more training, to do more to boost the capacity of the Nigerian military and of the Nigerian government.
As days pass, Sylvester Okere, a Nigerian-American businessman and advocate, says time is running out.
Some of these girls are already getting pregnant. These are someone's children. This could be my daughter. I have an 18-year-old daughter. I have a 12-year-old daughter. This could be my child. This could be my sister.
Since the schoolgirl's abduction, other attacks have taken place and more people have been kidnapped. Omolola Adeleosho says her group is planning another rally in Washington on July 14th and still holds the Nigerian government accountable.
Why is it that we cannot negotiate with Boko Haram? If it is money they want, give them money. 60 more women were taken. You know, why is it that it's so hard for the Jonathan administration to do something?
But as support dies down in some places, new people have joined the global campaign to free the Nigerian girls, like thousands of Filipino students who recently rallied in Manila. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenyan security officials in the coastal city of Mombasa have beefed up security as political and tribal tensions grow in the country. A strike by 220,000 engineers and metal workers has dealt another blow to South Africa's economy. And as Malawi celebrates 50 years of independence July 6th, many Malawians still live below the poverty level. Coming up, music from Ivory Coast. And in our feature segment, campaign against female circumcision in Cameroon. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky. In the sky.
Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
Happy Friday to you too, Sunny. And Sunny, I am guessing German football fans have a right to celebrate.
That's a good guess, Yehiz. Germany defeated France Friday 1-0 to advance to the semifinals of the World Cup football tournament in Brazil. And let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout out for Borussia Dortmund defender Mats Hummels, who scored the game's only goal in Rio de Janeiro in the 13th minute. Hummels knocked in a header off the crossbar from a free kick. The Germans are now only two victories away from their fourth world title. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, Germany won its three previous titles in 1954, 1974, and 1990. Final from Rio de Janeiro, Germany 1, France 0. The Germans now through to the final four of the World Cup. The Germans will play the winner of the Brazil-Colombia match in the World Cup semifinals on July 8th. The all-South American Brazil-Colombia game kicks off later Friday evening at 2000 UTC in Fortaleza. On Saturday, there will be two more quarterfinals. Argentina will battle Belgium in the capital, Brasilia, and that will be followed by a match between Costa Rica and the Netherlands in Salvador. I chatted with my Voice of America colleagues Ramon Taylor and Park Brewer about the quarterfinal matchups. First up is Ramon, and I asked him about the spicy Brazil-Colombia game.
The environment is spicy. That's almost an understatement. This is, hands down, I think, one of the most exciting matches, not just in the quarterfinals, but this entire World Cup up to date. Brazil has to be played top-notch. I think they've looked a little shaky in their last couple matches, especially against Mexico. And then Chile played superbly well against them, almost got away. They have to fill those gaps. Neymar has to come through as a superstar. But look, this Colombian team, I think, is going to give them a run for their money. And I agree. And I think they're actually better, maybe, than Chile and Mexico. So their star, James Rodriguez, 5 goals, the most of any player at the World Cup at this point. It's going to be a fascinating matchup to see him and Neymar head-to-head.
Do you see James as maybe the breakout star in Brazil?
I think so. I think he's also a leader. He has scored 5 goals. He also has 2 assists. But he's really brought, I think, a cohesive unit to this Colombian side that's going to be strong for the remainder of this World Cup, but also for years to come.
Let's move to Saturday now. Belgium will battle Argentina. Park, how do you see that game?
Well, it's most interesting that these two teams in the quarterfinals, they are the only two that came through the first round with the maximum 9 points. They won all 3 of their games in the first round. And in addition to that, both teams had to go to extra time.
That's right.
In the knockout round. Very interesting. So neither team will have an advantage as far as their physical capabilities. They've all played the extra time. Neither team, while they both scored 3 wins in the first round, neither of them was as impressive as we might have expected them to be. Lionel Messi, of course, the star for Argentina. We'll see if he can keep it going. And Belgium, of course, had that great game against the United States where they just attacked. And, you know, they could have had 4 or 5 goals if not for Tim Howard, the United States' great goalkeeping. So I think this is going to be a very good matchup. It'll be interesting to see if this one goes to extra time.
What about Messi, Park? I mean, he didn't score much in South Africa 4 years ago when you were in South Africa. This time around, he seems like he's really the focal point of Argentina's offense.
Well, he's had the 4 goals, and, of course, in the big game in the knockout round, he set up that great pass that gave them that victory in the extra time. So I think we're looking for more from him in this next round. And as all of us know, no European team has won the World Cup when it's been played in the Americas. So I think you've got to favor Argentina in this.
Okay, last quarterfinal on Saturday. Los Ticos from Costa Rica, maybe the surprise package in the quarterfinals, take on the Orange, the Dutch. What do you think?
I think that's very exciting to see the only non-South American and European team remainder, and some people are considering this the last Cinderella team in this tournament. Yeah. So everybody is excited for that. I know a lot of Brazilians will be going for the Ticos in that match. It's really exciting to see this small Central American team do so well. And are they Cinderella team? Yes, by our standards they are, but they've played extremely well. To try to put any sort of title on them as a Cinderella team, I think almost gives the other team an unfair advantage.
But let's not forget, the Dutch have the experience. They were the runners-up 4 years ago.
That's right.
You've got a lot of guys on this team that have been through it, whereas, you know, the Los Ticos, the Costa Ricans, they're in it. They have nothing to lose. So I expect them to attack and go right after the Dutch. Why not?
That's my VOA colleague, Park Brewer. And we also heard from VOA's Ramon Taylor in that spicy World Cup conversation.
I'm Shegwa Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Hello, everybody.
President Barack Obama and millions of other Americans are celebrating the USA's 238th Independence Day on this 4th of July. There are concerts, cookouts, and other festivities throughout the country, including a big fireworks show later this evening just outside our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. You might say the U.S. men's national soccer team provided a few fireworks during their recent World Cup campaign in Brazil. The underdog American squad was not expected to get out of a very tough first-round group that included Ghana, Germany, and Portugal. But the Americans finished second behind the Germans and advanced to the round of 16, where they lost a thrilling battle against Belgium 2-1 in extra time in Salvador, Brazil. As the American team packed its bags in Brazil, the boys in red, white, and blue got a congratulatory phone call from President Obama. Let's listen in now to what the president had to say to goalkeeper Tim Howard and team captain Clint Dempsey.
Clint?
Tim? Hello, Mr. President. How's it going?
Hello, Mr. President.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys just did great. And as somebody whose first sport was soccer, although I was never that good, to see the way you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country is unbelievable. And, you know, obviously the sport's been growing steadily just because so many kids are playing it at a young age. But, yeah, this is the first time where I think you really ended up having an entire country focused. And, Clint, you were fantastic. And, Tim, I think, you know, I don't know how you're going to survive the mobs when you come back home, man. You're just like, you're going to have to shave your beard so they don't know who you are.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
Well, you guys all did us proud, not just by how hard you played and how well you did, but also, yeah, you guys just carry yourselves with a lot of class, and it makes people really respect the sport, and you guys are really really great models for a lot of sportsmen here in the States. So I know it's disappointing, but what you guys accomplished is really really significant, and it'll make a difference in the country. So congratulate Coach, and I know maybe you got a couple other guys there. Fantastic job, everybody, and I hope I get a chance to see you guys again at the White House sometime soon. I still got my jacket that you guys gave me.
All right, awesome. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
U.S. President Barack Obama, who made a congratulatory phone call to Brazil, where he talked with goalkeeper Tim Howard and Captain Clint Dempsey of the USA's World Cup football team. If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, Germany defeated France Friday 1-0 in Rio de Janeiro to advance to the semifinals of the World Cup football tournament in Brazil. Borussia Dortmund defender Mats Hummels scored the game's only goal in the 13th minute, knocking in a header off the crossbar. The Germans will play the winner of the Brazil-Colombia match later Friday in the semifinals on July 8th. Finally, Algeria's World Cup team received a hero's welcome this week in the capital, Algiers. Thousands of fans lined the streets of Algiers as the players toured the city in an open-top bus draped in the team's green and white colors. The Desert Foxes of Algeria reached the World Cup's round of 16 for the first time in the country's history, narrowly losing to Germany 2-1 in extra time in Porto Alegre, Brazil. When the Algerian players returned home, they were greeted at the airport by Prime Minister Abdelmalek Salal, who hugged the team's Bosnian head coach Vahid Halihadzic. And as the team paraded through Algiers, fans waved Algerian flags and cheered for their returning heroes. And on that note, here's a sunny side of sports salute to the Desert Foxes of Algeria. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In our feature segment, the final part of our series on South Africa's craft beer revolution. And next, campaign against female circumcision in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Tiken Jaffa Kole from the Ivory Coast with African Revolution.
We want to win. said go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation. We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education. In your mind, brother, there is the power to change the world.
Tiken Yafakole from the Ivory Coast with African Revolution. In South Africa, there's a big demand now for craft beer. They also call it specialty beer or artisanal beer. It's brewed slowly according to traditional methods in small breweries using pure ingredients, including hops, malted barley, and mineral water. Commercial beer is produced faster in factories, often with chemicals and preservatives. The result is less flavorful than craft beer. Some fear the craft beer boom is fading. In the final part of our series on South Africa's craft beer revolution, Darren Taylor examines the future of this special brew.
A young man with a neatly trimmed goatee and a fedora hat opens a bottle of craft beer and takes a gulp inside a smart bar in Johannesburg. The customers are dressed in designer clothes. Luxury vehicles line the street outside. Rivulets of ice-cold water stream down gold taps, leading to kegs of specialty beer. For many South Africans, says beer writer Lucy Korn, craft beer is a fashion.
I think at the moment there are a lot of people who are drinking craft beer. They are drinking it simply because it's cool and they don't necessarily know anything about what they're drinking. It sort of sounds really patronizing, but some people don't even necessarily know if they like what they're drinking, but it's cool to drink it, so drink it anyway.
A walk-in fridge keeps hundreds of craft beers cold in the Linden liquor store in Johannesburg. Owner Jerry D'Souza says people who first started buying the specialty brews from him about 3 years ago did so because they wanted pure beer.
Now it's becoming a fad, it's becoming a fashion. You've got to have five different types of craft beers if you're worth anything.
But microbrewer André de Beer insists the growing demand for craft beer isn't just a fleeting fashion.
I don't think it's a fad that's going to fade away. It's here to stay. People enjoy a proper, flavoursome product, and as long as we keep on offering that as brewers, the customers will be there.
But several top brewers warn that bad practices are creeping into the sector that could threaten its long-term survival. Moritz Kalmeyer says he was recently asked to help some craft brewers who wanted to find out why their beer wasn't selling.
You can brew a brilliant beer and you can screw it up by putting it in a dirty keg. And this is what happened. Their beer was always sour, always off. Don't send out beer that is substandard. It will kill your business.
Korn says some craft brewers don't make consistently good beer.
A lot of the people who brew in the beer, they haven't tasted lots of different beers, so they're making beers in styles that they don't necessarily know what they should taste like. A lot of them have got teething problems.
Right now I'm busy cleaning up after having filtered one of our beers.
A brewer shows visitors around the Gilroy Brewery near Johannesburg. Owner Steve Gilroy says some microbrewers are packing their beer with CO2 and hops in the misguided belief that this will make it more popular.
Most of the brewers aren't listening to the public. They're turning people away from beer because they're making it A, too bitter, and they're making it B, far too gassy.
Korn says the downside to the craft beer explosion is people jumping on the bandwagon and thinking that they know how to make good beer when they don't.
I read tweets of people who drink certain beers and I taste them and I'm like, there is no way you're enjoying this beer. This beer is dreadful. You know?
Some brewers believe profiteers are the biggest dangers to the artisanal beer sector. Gilroy charges just over $2 for a pint of his beer, but some pubs and breweries charge much more than this, varying in some cases from $4 to $6 per pint.
I believe, and I'm seeing this with a lot of the craft breweries at the moment, they're elevating their prices. Now, this gives me the impression that they think the venture that they're in is a short-term venture, and they've got to recover costs in the shortest period of time. It's a sign of weakness.
As the boom continues and people seek to make as much money as possible from it, Korn sees no end soon to rising prices for specialty beer.
To be honest, it's getting more expensive. You know, over the last year or something, I'm seeing the prices going up. Now, I've got a friend who runs a bar in Cape Town, and he can get a keg from an American brewery, and even taking into account transport costs and customs and everything, at the end, it only costs a couple more rand for him to put that on tap in his bar than it does some of the locally produced beers, which is kind of ridiculous.
Chief Brewer at South African Breweries, Martin Brooks, is confident that some of the small beer makers will become big businesses.
I think over the next 5 to 10 years, you'll start to see some of the main current smaller craft players start to sort of grow into becoming more commercial, but hopefully still maintaining their independence and the integrity around the different styles of products which they're producing.
But before this happens, says Gilroy, breweries that are making bad beer will die off, as he puts it.
A lot of the craft brewers won't be sustainable. They're going to fall away. In about 3 years' time, South Africa's going to have a huge amount of second-hand brewing equipment kicking around.
Most close to the craft beer sector are, however, certain that specialty beer will continue to be an important part of South Africa's alcohol market. They say now that the country's developed a taste for artisanal beer, the days of it accepting that beer is only about factory-produced lager are over. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Cameroon and the World Health Organization have launched a campaign against female circumcision. The practice, which critics call female genital mutilation, is still practiced in the Central African nation for commercial reasons and traditional belief, the belief being that it makes a woman to be faithful to her husband. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
It was 5 a.m. when I arrived at the Nkobison neighborhood in Yaoundé, where a lady, popularly known as Ma Julie, secretly does female circumcision. She already has a 9-year-old girl brought by her mother to be circumcised.
My mother brought me here that we should meet one woman to treat us.
Ma Julie does not want me to come closer to her traditional operating area, but I can see two pairs of scissors and razor blades in a dish 3 meters away. She tells VOA she does not use the blades on her clients in the afternoon when temperatures are high because it can lead to excessive bleeding.
This thing with the toxemia will stop them for doing, so this thing don't take time since long, long time ago.
This is something that has always existed in our tradition. Our parents did it. Our grandparents did it. And our great-grandparents promoted this act. When you remove those parts of a woman, she eventually remains faithful to her husband. Don't you want a faithful wife? She asks. Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family says female circumcision is an economic activity and a source of livelihood to some of the promoters. The ministry says that is why it is giving money to the promoters to change their activities. Ma Julie received $100 but tells VOA that she makes more than that in a month.
They give me one fowl, then they give me 5,000. But today, so government talks more will stop this thing.
She says her clients give her a chicken and $10 for each circumcision. And now the government is asking them to stop the practice. We shall not, she concludes. Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family, Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua, says she encounters similar arguments from others who perform circumcision.
Si vous essayez de discuter avec ceux qui pratiquent, ils vont vous dire, mais ils vont vivre comment? C'est pour cela donc qu'il faut arriver.
She says when they argue with those who promote FGM, they ask you how they will live without it, and that is why you must give enough assistance for promoters to stop the activity, since you cannot ask them to abandon the practice without giving them money to live on. An estimated 140 million girls and women around the globe have undergone circumcision. According to medical experts, the practice causes severe pain and has several long-term consequences, including difficulties in childbirth. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Bitter sectarian violence continues in the Central African Republic. More than a year of conflict has killed thousands of people, displaced a million civilians, and led many Muslims to abandon their homes to seek safety in villages closer to the Muslim-dominated Sudan and Chad in the north. Most recently, dozens of people were killed in the town of Bambari in an attack by anti-Balaka militia, followed by reprisals by Muslim youths. Throughout the conflict, the United States has responded to address the resulting humanitarian crisis. With more than half the nation's population in need of aid and nearly 140,000 living as refugees in neighboring countries, the United States is deeply committed to ending the human suffering. Toward this end, nearly $51 million in additional assistance has been provided for Central African Republic relief, bringing total U.S. humanitarian aid to nearly $118 million this year. The newly announced funds will provide clean water, food, emergency health services, and relief supplies. Funding will also help support programs to assist displaced persons and reunite them with their families and surviving caregivers where possible. With rape, assault, and extreme acts of cruelty against innocent men, women, and children being committed every day, increased funding will also support counseling and other services for survivors of gender-based violence. The humanitarian needs in the Central African Republic are enormous, however, and cannot be met by a few donor nations alone. The international community can and must do more to provide assistance to help end the crisis. The Central African Republic's neighbors have welcomed nearly 140,000 refugees since December, and other nations must contribute. Significant resources are needed to save lives and alleviate suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.